Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm delighted to have back as a guest today James Lee Burke. We'll be discussing Mr. Burke's new novel, The Tin Roof Blowdown, recently published by Simon & Schuster. First of all, Jim, thanks for being back on again.
Thanks for having me again. I was on your show just a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, that was for, let the listeners know, Jesus Out to Sea, which is currently in bookstores. Mr. Burke and I had a discussion about that, and then Pegasus Descending will be available in paperback in late August. So readers are excited about those two events, and today we're going to focus on The Tin Roof Blowdown. First of all, Jim, congratulations on writing what I think is a very important novel.
Well, thanks very much.
Now, The Tin Roof Blowdown is a Dave Robichaux novel, and in the epigraph is from Proverbs, and as I was reading The Tin Roof Blowdown, I was thinking to myself, this story is almost kind of biblical in its intensity, and it's almost a prophetic thing about the Hurricane Katrina and what's happened in the country.
Well, it does have epic proportions, I think, not because I wrote it,
right?
Because of the event, and I did use that excerpt from the Book of Proverbs that deals with a flood and the borders that Jehovah Yahweh set upon the oceans. It's one of my favorite passages in the Bible, actually.
Yes, and in Tin Roof Blowdown, it goes back to the events in August of 2005, and Father Jude LeBlanc is a character who is one of the centerpieces of the story, and he goes to the Ninth Ward, the only place that will have him. And one of the things that I like about the Tin Roof Blowdown, Jim, is that I think that one of the things that Father Jude LeBlanc does is he gives kind of an accurate appraisal of the Ninth Ward. He doesn't think that bombs were set off or any of those kind of things. But and you give a little bit of the history of what actually did happen in the Ninth Ward, though.
Yes, when the storm hit, of course, you know, people were terrified. And then people in the Ninth Ward said they heard explosions. And they feared that terrorists or racists were dynamiting the levee. And as Dave Robichaux said, no terrorists were needed. The levee began to come apart. And of course, the lower Ninth Ward was inundated and many died.
And on page 34, you describe that really the entire city in one night was reduced back to the technological level of the Middle Ages, and that was an important event as well, is that here you had this large population in this one area that you see the danger of the reliance we have on technology when something happens so quickly like this did.
Yes, and I think all of us have experienced that to some degree with brownouts, blackouts, but in this instance, as Dave says, the entire power grid of the city was made null and void. And this 21st century metropolis was suddenly no different from a city in medieval Europe in the year 1300.
And in Tin Roof Blowdown, one of the things that I like is I think we see the maturity of Dave Robichaux as a character in understanding and coming to terms with the things that he can change in the world and the things that he is just simply not going to be able to overcome. And there was a beautiful line. He says something like, "The truth is, I don't want to talk about it. If age brings wisdom, it lies in the realization that most talk is useless, that you stay out of other people's grief." And that's kind of a change for Dave Robichaux, isn't it, Jim? Because he, in the past, he might have gone off on some tangents here where he keeps his eye on the ball pretty well in the Tin Roof Blowdown, I think.
Yes, he makes that statement on two levels. One, about the fact fact that rhetoric really solves no problem, and ultimately the only thing that corrects evil, that thwarts evil, is the application of good against it. But when he cautions himself about not involving himself in the grief of others, he doesn't often take his advice. But I think that kind of tension, that ethical tension, is what afflicts all of us to some degree. We know that we have to become involved in the lives of others. We have to help those in need. At the same time, we have to be able to choose our battlegrounds with some degree of wisdom. So there's no formula that works.
Right. And in Tin Roof Blowdown, the part of the plot which is fascinating is that we all know that there was looting going on, and part of the plot of the Tin Roof Blowdown is that some gang members get involved in doing some devastation, and they pick on the wrong guy to go in his house and take some of his stuff away from.
Yeah, these looters, there are several of them, and they are under the command, supposedly, of a guy named Bertrand Molossaw. These kids are professional wise guys, gangbangers, street pukes. There are lots of names for them. But they've stolen a boat, a power boat, and they're looting homes in the uptown area of New Orleans. And they pick this one deserted home that is loaded with all kinds of interesting things. And they rip the walls out, and they fill pillow slips with jewelry, and they find some contraband, cocaine, and bogus money, counterfeit money. And then they decide to vandalize the house while they're in there. And Dave Robichaud says it looks like an army of Visigoths has marched through this antebellum home. They use garden rakes to tear the chandeliers out of the ceilings. They urinate in the refrigerator and seasoning drawers. It's just, it's incredible what these guys do to the interior of the house, not knowing that the house is owned by Sidney Kovic, the most dangerous gangster in New Orleans, a guy who may have cut off another man's legs with a chainsaw. And of course, when they discover whose home they've robbed and vandalized,
yeah, rightly so. Yeah, Stanley Kovic is not—he's not a nice guy, and
he's really a dangerous guy. And Cleet Purcell, when he was a kid, bounced Kovic's head up and down on a concrete curb on Magazine Street.
Yeah.
Of course, Kovic has never forgotten who did that.
No, he's never forgotten it, and Cleet Purcell is back in great form, and of course we know that Cleet's not going to evacuate. I mean, we kind of know that Cleet isn't the kind of guy that's going to clear out of the city when they say, "Hey, it's gotten dangerous," because for Cleet, any place he's at is dangerous.
Yeah, Cleet's a great character, and we meet him in the first pages of the book when he is in the quarter just before Katrina makes landfall in New Orleans.
And another character, Jim, that I really like is Otis. And I really like the discussion of the bond between fathers and daughters in the Tin Roof Blowdown. I thought it was very, very touching and very well done, with not just Dave and Al Affair, but Otis and his daughter and other men and women, and the strength of that bond.
Yeah, Otis Baylor is one of my favorite characters, not just in this book, but of any I've written about. He's the insurance salesman from North Alabama, whose father and uncle had both been members of the Ku Klux Klan. But he's cut out of different cloth, and he's a very decent man, and he's radicalized politically by what he sees being done to many people whose claims are being unfairly denied by insurance companies.
And one of the things about the Tin Roof Blowdown, which we're discussing today, is that we talked, when you wrote Pegasus Descending, Jim, we talked about how the confluence events that took place, that for Dave Robichaux to be the narrator of this ongoing story, and some of the things that we talked about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and even when we talked a few weeks ago, are becoming more visible in the papers, the depth and magnitude of the fraud and the cover-up. And that's really where Otis Baylor, I really like that about him as well, because he starts to see a side of himself that even he is afraid of.
Yes. He discovers that he has a far greater potential for violence than he had thought. And, of course, his daughter is a victim of gang rape. She is raped by the same men who have been vandalizing and robbing the neighborhood during the storm.
And Jim, Al Affair plays a prominent role in the Tin Roof Blowdown, and we see her role as a writer. And I was really so happy when you talk about one of my favorite writers. You say that Al Affair is taking a class at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette by Ernest Gaines. And
yeah.
Boy, he is one of my favorite writers of all time.
Yeah, he's a very good writer. He's a fine fellow too.
Yeah, and it's also interesting is that Al Affair is not as affected technologically as Dave is, because she knows actually how to work these things. And so that I like that interplay you had there too between the generations. What was Dave's devastation? Al Affair had some systems in place where she wasn't quite as affected as Dave was.
Yeah, she's working on her first novel. She's just graduated from Reed College and is home and writing, and this really bad guy destroys her computer and her manuscripts. But she explains to Dave how she emailed Ernest Gaines each night all of her work, and she had a disc with a friend, I think. She uses the same system I do, and our youngest daughter, Al Affair, the real Al Affair, whose name is Al Affair.
Yeah.
Yeah. is a novelist. Al Affair Burke's new book, Dead Connection, just came out 2 days ago.
Beautiful, and I hope to have her on the show, because I'm reading great things about this book. So,
it's a good one.
Yeah, listeners can hope to hear her discuss the new book in August.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jim, when I was reading the Tin Roof Blowdown the second time, to me there were kind of some resonations of the Electric Mist with Confederate Dead, which is one of my favorites, with Tin Roof Blowdown, some of the metaphors you use and some of the visualizations you use. And I would imagine that had to be enjoyable as well. There's just some parts of the novel that are just stylistically so beautiful that I'm not going to give any of those away on during the interview, but it really has a kind of that dreamlike element of Electric Mist, which I liked so much.
Well, thanks very much. I used the story, the real story, of a Catholic priest in the lower Ninth Ward who tried to get his parishioners to leave, but 60% of the people in the Ninth Ward did not own automobiles. Also, it was the end of the month. Most of them had not been paid. They had no money, and there was nowhere to go. There was no hotel room available from New Orleans all the way to St. Louis.
Mm.
But he stayed with them, and he drowned with them. And I used that story in the book. And in the book, people see lights under the water in the vicinity of the church where all of these people died. And Dave tries to discover the source of the light beneath the water. But anyway, it was my metaphor for what happened to those people who are broken and rejected.
Yes, and we can never forget those people. And on page 245, Ronald Bledsoe is there's a scene, and Dave's thinking is that we like to think that we revere Jesus, Mother Teresa, and Saint Francis of Assisi, but when we feel threatened, we want the Earp brothers and Doc Holliday. And I thought that was a very interesting observation as well. I think that the magnitude of this, what happened in Katrina and what's happening in Iraq, I think people are just, they're kind of fed up. And in the Tin Roof Blowdown, I think some of that rage that so many of us feel, there's kind of a voice to it, a moderated voice, but a lot of people do feel that way.
Well, it's a volatile time in our history. I think we're in the midst of the vortex. We don't see it all because we're in the funnel itself, but it's probably going to prove out to be one of the most dramatic periods in Western history, I think.
Yes, I think you're right. I think you're right, Jim. Jim, there's an observation that you make as well, and I found this fascinating when you were talking about during the 1960s, there was a black minister in Oakland who wrote an open letter to the Black Panthers talking about the importance in the black community of the church and the family, and that the church was usually the Southern Baptist. But you also talk in this riff that you have that this minister forgot, or that this young minister forgot, that his young friends did not understand the atavistic nature of the loyalty that black families have, and that the matriarchs run those families and do not dime out their grandchildren. I love the way you phrased that and the way you explained that in the book.
Yeah, Dave alludes to the letter written by a real minister in Oakland, California, a fellow who knew the Panthers, Bobby Seale and Elridge Cleaver and Huey Newton. And he said that these boys, as he called them, mm-hmm. he said these young boys had forgotten in their radicalization, their embracing of Mao and the whole Panther ethos, that the center of the black community historically has always been the church. And the home is matriarchal, and blue-collar black families, there's a very rigid code of protecting one's own. And a black family does not give up its own to the system. They'll do whatever it takes to protect the child, even when they have to break the law themselves. It's in their nature. Whereas very often in a middle class Anglo-Saxon home, we trust the law to do the right thing by our kids and turn them in.
Yeah.
So a person can choose, of course. But the point is, de facto, the black community has always taken its leadership from the church.
Yes.
Always.
Yes. And that's one of the
politicians, of course, proselytize the church and the black community first.
Jim, in the Tin Roof Blowdown, as the story and the plot develop and then come to a crescendo, I must say that when I read the ending, I thought that it was, I had to put the book down because the ending was so lyrical and the prose was so powerful. I'm not being disingenuous when I say this, that I was moved by the last 3 to 4 paragraphs of the novel in a way that few novels move me. And
well, I think the conclusion of the book is probably the best writing I ever did, but I'll let others judge it. But it deals with the aftermath of the storm and the people who were lost and the lights that others seem to have seen underneath the surface of the water.
Yes, and it was, how many times did you write that, Jim, before you got the words just the way you wanted to?
Well, it didn't take long, oddly enough. It just seemed to come naturally at the end of the story. I used the metaphor of a giant pewter-colored chalice filled with dark water and with broken lights in it that were like light emanating from a broken Eucharist. And of course, we remember the lines in the New Testament that the sacrifice of Jesus was the sacrifice that is broken and rejected by the world. That Christianity is all about rejection, not acceptance. It's always been about rejection. The real lesson, I think, teaching of Christ is always about rejection. He always cautioned his followers to fear acceptance. Those who are first will be last, and those who are last will be first. He always indicated that the world will reject his followers.
And one of the things, thank you for saying that so eloquently, by the way, one of the things that the Tin Roof Blowdown, I think that I love about it so much, is that it gives respect, I think, to the people that were killed during Katrina as well. And it seemed to me that might have been in the back of your mind when you wrote Jesus Out to Sea, the short story, and then through Tin Roof Blowdown. You wanted to give a voice to the people that aren't walking this earth anymore as well, too, and tell their side of the story a little bit.
Yes, I think that's what Dave tries to do, Dave Robichaux, and all the books. He tries to give voice to those who have none. And I think that's what a good protagonist does. Ron Hansen said that once. I just have enormous respect for Ron Hansen, both artist and man. But Ron was asked why he often wrote about people he had never met, French nuns living in a cloistered convent at the turn of the century. Wrote about the Dalton gang. He wrote about Hitler's family. But he said he felt the novelist's charge was to give power and dimension and life to those whose mouths are stopped with dust. Ron's a great writer. Oh, boy.
Yeah, I've read some of his stuff. He is a great writer.
Mariette in Ecstasy is one of the best novels in American literature. What a book. What a book.
Beautiful. Well, Jim, with the Tin Roof Blowdown now, was it cathartic at all when you were writing it? Because the scenes that you describe in the novel, you tell the reader, if you get a chance to hear some of these things, walk away from it. Don't embrace it at a certain level. And as you were writing it, now that you're done, are you relieved that Jesus Out to Sea is now done and that the Tin Roof Blowdown is now finished? Emotionally, that must have been a very difficult time for you.
Well, these are the best books I could write, and I always feel upon completing a book that if I've done as well as I could, that I've, in effect, fulfilled that what, at least for me, is the goal that I have in my life, to tell the truth at least as well as I know it, and to put it down in a way that other people can share in it. I think it's about greatest pleasure an artist gets.
Beautiful. Well, I thank you so much for appearing on the show again. We've been discussing The Tin Roof Blowdown, published by Simon & Schuster. Jim, congratulations on a just a sweetheart of a novel, and I look forward to talking with Alifair about her new novel. And then readers have Pegasus Descending and Jesus Out to Sea, and we talked about The Electric Mist during that interview. So it's a real busy time for James Lee Burke, and congratulations on the success, my friend.
Well, thanks a million, Casey. I sure appreciate it.
Okay, and we'll catch up with you down the road.
I'll see you, partner.